Committee. Thank you so much. This morning we will start with an update to WMATA's joint development policies. The purpose of our request today is to bring forward some recommended updates to the joint development policies and seek the board's approval for it. We're also seeking approval to remove the requirement, which was established in 2015, to direct all joint development revenue to the CIP. And I'll explain that in more detail as we go on. Joint development is a Federal Transit Administration program which encourages the co-location of transit facilities with private development. Metro has one of the most active joint development programs in the nation. The property that we own, unsurprisingly, is directly at or around or on top of our Metro stations. Some of the earliest ground leases that we executed were at Farragut North, Metro Center, and McPherson Square. And since 1975, when the program began here at Metro, we have completed more than 30 joint development projects, and we continue to work on new projects. At any given time, the Office of Real Estate and Parking works on approximately 4 to 8 joint development feasibility studies. That is, that's the list, what our current list is on the right-hand side. So we are looking into the future and trying to understand how to organize our transit facilities so that WMATA can continue to provide its operations, services, and transit mission and do so thoughtfully before we put out a project for joint development. So that's really a due diligence exercise that we undertake on a regular schedule. We concurrently are actively negotiating 4 to 8 joint development transactions at any given time. And that list of projects that we're currently working on is on the right-hand column, and those include things like Bethesda, where a new office building is being proposed right at 3 Metro Center, office or residential, I should say. At Brookland, we're in the midst of finalizing a joint development agreement. At College Park, we recently executed a joint development agreement, and now we're managing that interaction, relationship, construction, plans, and projects between the developer, WMATA, and then also the Purple Line at College Park, and the list goes on. WMATA's had joint development policies, started establishing them actually 5 years after its very first ground lease at Farragut North. So the very first set of policies for joint development were established by the board in 1980. Over the years, anywhere between every 3 to 8 years, the policies are updated. And that's usually to just reflect the evolution of how Metro thinks about its joint development program, but also how the real estate industry evolves. For example, TOD today is a very well-known term with set of affiliated concepts. Back in 1975, nobody was talking about TOD. And so as a result, our joint development policies and how we practice evolves. So our last set of joint development policies were adopted in 2014. So it's now 4 years later, and we would like to bring forward some proposed updates. On the last item that we'll be talking about, which has to do with how WMATA directs joint development revenue, prior there was no restriction to how joint development revenue was applied. It could be applied either to operating or capital. And then there was another program. I don't want to confuse things too much. But in 2015, the board directed all joint development revenue explicitly to capital. So that's the background on when the board approved that policy. But before we get to that, I'll go back to the joint development policies. The changes that we are suggesting are twofold. The first is really a structural change to the documents that the board approves. Currently, we have one document that's called the Joint Development Policies and Guidelines, and any change to that document requires board approval, even if it is process or procedural or just even an improvement to language as a better communication tool. That has to come for board approval. The challenge with the existing structure is that one document serves as both the board's policy document as well as WMATA's external communication document. So what we would like to do is actually separate the two. Have one document that is the board's policies, and then delegate to the general manager the ability and the authority to publish joint development program guidelines, which would need to comply with the board's policies as well as with the FTA's guidelines for joint development. The second update that we're looking to make is more substantive. What we're doing here is actually to codify a number of different policies and practices that WMATA has been applying, but that the board has not formally adopted in the past. Some of those policies and practices include how we manage our assets. What are the priorities? Is it transit, or is it revenue, or is it other? So this set of policies seeks to codify a lot of our practices and policies. The other thing that we're looking to do is to make improvements to the board approval process, which includes establishing criteria by which the board would review and approve joint development projects, and provides a little bit more clarity and guidance both to the board, but as importantly to staff. In short, we're trying to make the joint development program more easily understood and accessible, both for the board, who must review the merits of a project, as well as for external stakeholders who desire to engage WMATA in joint development. Okay, this is a comparison chart of what our existing policy state and what we are proposing that the new policy state. Currently, on board approvals, the board approves at four different times a single joint development project. The first is prior to our issuing a solicitation, the board would approve that. We are suggesting no change to that. The second is approval to negotiate and execute a term sheet. This stage, upon discussion and reflection, doesn't really add more information for the board, and it introduces a couple-month more process for the developers who are engaging with us, and introduces just another level of uncertainty as they proceed down the path of negotiating with us. So my aim is to figure out how to streamline the approval process, the internal approval process, so that we can have a faster transaction turnaround with developers and deliver these projects faster, while still giving the board and WMATA the protections of oversight and review that it needs. And so the term sheet approval, I don't believe, really adds much value in this process. So we have proposed to eliminate that particular approval. The joint development agreement would continue once it has been negotiated to come back to the board to ensure that what we have negotiated complies with the project that the board thought it was getting when it approved the solicitation. And then lastly, the current policy just broadly says any amendments to a joint development agreement, which is very vague. And so what we'd like to introduce is some materiality to the types of amendments that would come back to the board for approval. So for example, during the course of any real estate transaction, particularly a very long one, there will naturally be changes to the joint development agreement as you go along to adjust to how the project is evolving. Again, to introduce that uncertainty that, you know, minor or other changes may not be approved to the board when the developer is already a partner of ours, particularly if those are non-material changes, I don't think really benefits WMATA, nor does it advance joint development more smoothly. So in our current proposal, the materiality is that if the proposed changes to the joint development would change the project from what the board expected to see or expected to receive in revenue, that level of criteria, then it would come back to the board. Okay, next on to evaluation criteria. The existing policy right now just states some general transit-oriented development objectives, but it does not actually outlay the criteria by which staff should be presenting the joint development opportunity to the board, nor give the board guidance on, you know, what how they should actually evaluate a project. So previously, the objectives for joint development included things like enhances connections to transit. These are really design principles. Promotes and enhances ridership, fosters safe station access, reduces automobile dependency, increases ped bike trips, et cetera, et cetera. What we're going to now and what we're proposing is that there are five criteria. The first is that the joint development project must maintain or enhance transit ridership, safety, and or access, must maintain or enhance operations and maintenance of transit, services, this is not written here on the thing, but on transit services and or operations. It must maintain or enhance and have a positive fiscal impact, which is all inclusive, by the way. That can mean that we have an enhancement in revenue. It can also mean that we have a reduction in expenses. But whatever the current fiscal, whatever the current cost of the property today must be improved on, and the bottom line improved on in the future joint development state from a fiscal impact perspective. Must be consistent with local land use and economic development plans, and underpinning all of this is that it must comply with FTA guidelines. Okay. Then on the more policy-related matters, in the current joint development policies and guidelines, there is no stated policy on asset management. There is no stated policy on how WMATA evaluates the need for replacement transit facilities, and there's also no public policies. We have been practicing a certain way, but these have just not, our practices had not previously been codified, and so we're looking now to codify our practices. So for asset management, transit is the priority and the reason that WMATA owns property. In the case that we can accommodate private development, we would then seek to not only provide the transit services, but also to develop land so that we can maximize revenue, manage financial risk, and we do need some level of continuing control, as is a requirement by the FTA for WMATA property. Again, currently, and this comes up most frequently in the discussion about parking, there's a lot of lore around WMATA's one-for-one replacement parking requirement. There is no such parking requirement. And so, but we do need to continue to provide parking. And so, but there's other facilities as well. Parking is one. Bus facilities is another. Bike and ped facilities, et cetera. There's all kinds of transit facilities that need to be replaced in the case of a joint development. So in this case, the instruction is to analyze the demand for future transit assets, and in our joint development, we would replace or even add transit operations capacity. So there's an analytical requirement for us to assess the transit need and use this redevelopment opportunity at any given station to really improve transit service. So that's what the new policy states. And then lastly, on public policies, it is logical that WMATA and its joint developments, as we're negotiating and working with developers who are going to be bringing new tenants, whether they're residential or whether they're employees, that we ask for the developers to really sponsor and come up with a transit demand management plan. How is it that you're going to communicate to the residents of this TOD what the smart trip benefits are, what commuter benefits are? Let's work directly with, for example, Kaiser Permanente at New Carrollton with 900 new employees on making sure that that organization understands what smart benefits are and what commuter benefits they can provide to their employees. This all is a natural synergy which we've just not, again, codified. The other two public policies that we've introduced, and again, these have been historical practices, but had just not been written down, is sustainability. we really are looking to either adopt and make sure that the local jurisdictions plans or sustainability priorities are incorporated into WMATA's sustainability requirements and have certification at a nationally recognized by a nationally recognized certification program. And then same thing for affordable housing. It's the same relationship. Each jurisdiction has a different approach to affordable housing. We're not looking to impose a different standard or anything else. We're really looking to work with the jurisdictions and make sure that their priorities for affordable housing are incorporated into our joint developments. There are some jurisdictions that would really like to see a much more aggressive affordable housing requirement, particularly on top of Metro, because it's part of an affordability equation for a household that would qualify for affordable housing. In those cases where, let's say, a jurisdiction may want an increased affordable housing requirement, the joint development guidelines or policies, I'm sorry, currently state that we would work with the jurisdictions to make sure that that funding source and that subsidy for an increase in affordable housing requirements at Metro was identified, and that subsidy would not come from a WMATA land value. So that's what the policy states. So that is the joint development policies. And then I'd like to address this one last issue, which is the use of joint development revenue. So the FTA allows transit agencies to use joint development revenue flexibly, either towards operating or capital. And WMATA actually used to practice that way. And then in 2015, there was a program called the TIIF, the TIF. It was closed and by the board. And in that process of closing out the TIIF, there was a component of the resolution that stipulated that all future revenue from existing joint development projects would be dedicated to capital. Given both the one dedicated funding that hopefully is being finalized now, and also the desire to have flexibility to apply these revenues either to operating or capital as the needs arise, we're actually looking to reincorporate that flexibility and remove this requirement that all joint development revenue goes to the capital budget. And if there are any questions for that, yes. That is what I have, and so just our recommendation to update the joint development policies and also to remove the requirement to direct all revenue to the CIP. Previously, again, I mentioned this TIIF, which is where joint development revenues would go, and I don't have the complete history on that, but yes, there was sort of allocation back to jurisdictions or whatever. In this particular case, with the TIIF no longer a program, The joint development revenues would just get, whether it goes to capital or operating, whichever the choice is, and the CFO is here with me to explain further if needed, but that would go into our general revenues, so let's say general operating revenues, and get used to support the entire system. Or if it were to go to capital, it would go into the availability of capital for the capital program, which the board approves as it does the operating budget. That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also wanted to thank my fellow colleagues for spending more time on this subject with the staff, and particularly Tony for leading us along the lines of his expertise, and you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just jump in here. I really think we should debate whether we should have revenue coming forward to go into operating, given the general manager's 3% cap on operating. I really believe that it should go into capital. I don't agree that we should go back to where we were in 2015, where we had these pots of money by jurisdiction, which was so confusing and so parochial. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we should do operating. I think we should just limit any revenue to capital as a policy. So we can talk about it over
the debate. Well, thanks for the thanks. You are too generous. Really thanking these folks because they put up with a lot of questions from us. I suspect that you could probably describe what a lot meant more than I could. I've been on the board as an alternate member for a number of years, and I think these policies really streamline how the board interacts with the program, because it was confusing to me from the get-go as to why we touched many of these projects so many times. So I welcome the streamlining. I think it's not really a question, but I think for the board, you know, the notion of approving term sheets was always a little bit uncomfortable for me, just based on a lot of years in real estate, because they're way downstream. You know, folks have been working with developers oftentimes for months and maybe years to negotiate terms, and for the board to at the final moment get to approve them, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but there's a lot of history, and as Nina suggested, the development community sees that as risk, appropriately so. But having said that, with this change, I think it'll be incumbent on the board to be really clear about agreed on expectations going into negotiations, and sort of what the board understands about return. Because if we begin to change the parameters over the life of development, that'll introduce the same risk in the development community. They will not be comfortable working with WMATA. So really it's about the board as much as the policy change to understand that. And so I'm looking forward to having that discussion at the board level at some point. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you for all of the effort in trying to put this together. It's obviously, you know, been a collaborative, and I think it is, as Tony mentioned, it's obviously you know, an improvement. I feel pretty good, and also that just understanding from what Tom said, just kind of going to what he was asking about, that I think that what this exercise was doing was trying to clarify, streamline, and also provide flexibility that we as a board are comfortable with, and really kind of put that down and make that somewhat clear. There still is, as Tony knows and as Nina knows, there's still work on the guidelines that are underneath that. I think that we still, although as a part of this process, we're not, you know, we're kind of moving out of that space. We still want to, I want to still feel comfortable about what that work product ends up finally looking like as it relates to this process. So I'm hopeful that we'll stay engaged in that part of it. But I think that I feel comfortable with the flexibility. I mean, we put a lot of time and effort into this, so I'm very pleased that we're finally getting around to this and hopeful that, you know, this will work well for the development community, work well for us as well, to help move forward projects and provide real clarity or more clarity. So I feel good about this, and I feel comfortable supporting it today.
Mr. Chairman, if I may offer some thoughts with respect to the recommended use of funds from joint development in the future. In 2015, when the board directed that all future funds go to capital, Metro was asking jurisdictions to provide 8 to 10% jurisdictional funding growth on the operating budget each year. Today, Metro is about to go into a new era that hopefully provides stable capital funding, but more fundamentally provides a clear commitment in terms of limited operating subsidy to Metro from the jurisdictions. This new environment, Mr. Chairman, I believe requires flexibility in how the board structures some of its policies, and I think in this particular case, strikes the right balance, given all of the challenges that Metro continues to face with respect to ridership and revenues. And so my thought is that the recommendation that Nina has provided is really the right one for Metro going forward, and I'll urge the board to consider that.
I think we got to keep in mind that eventually this all gets back to the formula. So it's not going to be going to one jurisdiction or another. It's basically going to be into the formula, which then gets spread out as the region and as the boards agree to. So I think that's part of the concern, is that, you know, some of this money gets only to one jurisdiction. That's just not the case. That's not how we would manage the dollars.
I'm just wondering, from a committee perspective, would it make sense to, in the budget formulation process, Mike, I'm glad you're here, because we Dennis would know during budget formulation expected revenue for that budget year. So maybe we can explicitly have that as part of the budget formulation process, but provide flexibility as to what's proposed. But again, the committee and the board would review the proposal for a particular year and conclude on that proposal, but include the flexibility.
Talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars here, right? This is a drop in the bucket anyway, right?
That's right.
But I'm just concerned if we have a cap on operating ball at 3%, how the drop in the bucket's going to affect the 3% cap versus my proposal, which was to keep it on the capital side. But Tony, I could support your suggestion.
For Dennis, is that workable from the standpoint of the budget formulation and execution process?
Absolutely. Thank you.
that this this is actually a much easier topic to get through. What we're bringing before the board today is for your review and approval of Metro's transit-oriented development objectives. And this is different than joint development. Joint development is really what does Metro do on its own property. Transit-oriented development is a much broader geography than Metro-owned property, and it really encompasses a lot of property, Metro, private, other public agency property, that is within walking distance of transit. And this is really what people colloquially or in planning circles talk about when they talk about TOD. Their basic design principles include intermodal, where you can connect within walking distance, that's part of the intermodal, within biking distance to bus, to train, to fixed rail, to other kinds of modes of transit. It typically implies a mix of uses around transit, higher densities, as well as pedestrian friendly. Okay. So the question is what is Metro's role in TOD, and why would we adopt a TOD objective? There is some precedence and guidance from the region about transit-oriented development, and the Council of Governments in their Region Forward Goals explicitly states that the region seeks transit-oriented and mixed-use communities emerging in regional activity centers, and the idea is to capture new employment and household growth in proximity to transit. Yes.
So it's so huge that you know, we're going to hopefully put a dent in it, but we're not going to be able to serve all those nodes.
No, absolutely. Okay. I mean, our interest will really be around those nodes where it impacts Metro Rail and Metro Bus the most. The board itself has actually expressed a priority for TOD in its 2013 to 2025 strategic plan. And it the way that it addresses it in that plan, in that strategic plan, is to say that the region should, or that we should address underutilized capacity by working with the jurisdictions as they pursue land use actions that will result in ridership growth, and that will work with the local jurisdictions to develop policies and plans. So that's the framework, and this current, sorry, I don't know what's going on. Okay. So, again, these are some of the reasons that we're interested in this space, whether it's on our property or on others' property. There are direct benefits to Metro because of TOD. What happens around our Metro stations has a direct impact on ridership for Metro. So maximizing bike and pedestrian connections to transit improves people's use of transit. Integrating transit services within communities promotes transit use. And then another direct impact of TOD to Metro is that it's a way that we can give back to the jurisdictions that support us because TOD increases economic activity and tax revenue for the jurisdictions, maximizes use of existing infrastructure. There's environmental sustainability benefits, congestion management benefits, and cost of living choices for the residents in the jurisdictions. So there's a whole host of synergistic goals that exist between Metro off of our property. So what are the policies that matter the most specifically to ridership? And it's really two things. It's density and walkability. So we use the example of Rhode Island Avenue, where we have a joint development. But in 2015, this is not on Metro property, but in an adjacent property, a developer put in a PUD for 1,600 housing units and 300,000 square feet of retail. What was ultimately approved, not by us, but by the Zoning Commission in Washington, D.C., was a slightly lower housing count and a slightly lower retail count. This is totally within the jurisdictions. That's their role and their set of responsibilities for how to for land use, for adopting land use policies. But when you just take a look at those minor changes, we're able to estimate what that reduction in density means to ridership for Metro. And this is just, again, just an example of how density and walkability matter. If the PUD at its highest density had been approved, that would have meant 200 more trips on the weekday for 200 more riders. And that translates to $121,000 in annual revenue to Metro. So, again, there's this direct correlation between density, walkability, and ridership. So that's why we have an interest in this. So specifically, what is our role? To provide planning support to the jurisdictions as they develop their land use policies for TOD and as they also seek to balance travel demand. So again, it's more of a data provider, information provider. That is a role that we currently serve and will continue to serve, particularly in terms of advocating for or supporting TOD. We have an advocacy and collaboration role. We have objectives, as we've just stated, for TOD, and we would like to collaborate with the local jurisdictions more and more aggressively to achieve these goals. So there's an advocacy and collaboration role that we have. And then lastly, in TOD, we have our own portfolio to manage that contributes to an overall TOD objective, and that's our joint development program. So finally, getting to the meat of this, here are the three areas that WMATA would like to share as our objectives for TOD, whether or not the jurisdictions adopt them. But this is really the three areas that, again, contribute directly to ridership. One is around zoning codes and ordinances. We encourage jurisdictional partners to update their local codes and ordinances to achieve higher densities of development, mix of uses, and lower parking requirements around our metro rail stations and along major bus corridors. This doesn't mean that the jurisdictions have to do it. We're just saying that these kinds of actions help support ridership on metro. Number two is pedestrian and bicycle access. We support the investment in ped bike improvements, again, coming to the metro. This is more than likely off of metro property, so it's difficult for metro to implement, but we could work much more closely with the jurisdictions on seeking different forms of funding, on working into a TOD plan, a pedestrian and bicycle connection. And you see that, for example, at Tyson's right now. Since the Silver Line is going out there, that they are real. The jurisdiction is actively working on increasing those bike ped connections because buildings that are currently within a quarter mile walk are actually not walkable, and so people are choosing to drive. So these are initiatives that are off metro property that the jurisdictions and metro could collaborate on because they have a direct impact on ridership. And then lastly, and this is sort of an obvious statement, but how it impacts ridership is as follows. We would really like to see TOD in less developed areas around our undeveloped metro stations. Specifically, that mix of employment centers, commercial, retail, and other uses that draw ridership out of the, you know, that there's that reverse commute to our suburban metro rail stations. Having that reverse commute has a direct impact to our bottom line. So we would like to see employment centers in our suburban communities as well. They don't have to be as dense, clearly, as in the major employment corridors, such as downtown DC or Tyson's, you know, Bethesda and other, but some mix of employment at our underdeveloped metro stations would benefit the ridership system. So with that, I'm available for any questions or discussion that you would like to have. Correct. Thank you.
So move.
Second.
Greg, make sense, as I was on the board when we pivoted, to just spend a minute or so about Accenture. We hired Accenture to help us with this issue. Well, it was just historical. appetite there now? So the app would be linked to a card. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I just want to say I think that this is great. It's flexible, and also appreciate sort of being measured and allowing the rapid changes that are going to continue to happen and to stay flexible with that. I think that's a fantastic approach, so it's good.
I did. And I'm, since I was asking a lot of questions when this was last up here as NEEP, so I may ask the same questions or you may educate me in the process. So we're going into a system where we'll have two payment vehicles, traditional smart trip cards or your smartphone. Is that correct?
So there's just to put a fine point on there, you'll literally have a virtual smart trip card inside your mobile app.
Right. So but we're not right, we're not retiring smart trip cards.
No.
And the last time we had this conversation, at least the experience in the marketplace was that most people were still using the equivalent of the smart trip cards, and that even though places like Chicago and London had Oyster cards, and that people were still, in the large majority, they weren't really using their smartphones to access the systems. They were using their Oyster card or their smart trip card. Has that model changed in the last 2-3 years since we've had this conversation?
That model has changed significantly. So we, in fact, we just met with representatives from TFL this week, and they, their Oyster card is sort of the granddaddy of the marketplace. They've got millions upon millions of these issues. They now introduced the concept of going contactless in their credit card, as well as mobile. They had, within a couple of months, converted 35,000 people voluntarily and said, I'm going to mobile. I use mobile every day as part of my physical being. I have it in my right hand every day, every moment. And now all I do is just tap it to plug it and go again. So they're watching Oyster, the actual Oyster card itself is kind of stagnant in terms of take-up, but mobile and contactless are now going to be on the box.
Do you have some articles you can just distribute around to board members so we can see that marketplace change? Thanks. Now, when you introduce the mobile app, I assume you'll introduce it to Android and Apple at the same time, versions? But my question is, will the debut of the platforms on both Android and Apple be at the same time, or is there some delay and two-step process? And final question, when you have the Smart Trip app, will you be able to load onto your Smart Trip card from the app? Will you be able to make a mobile upload on your
apps?
You'll be able to do that as well. So you won't be stuck doing the desk PC as a way to.
Desktop, you want to get you interrupt a few more, and you need a little bit of
and this is the question where I don't know now, but is there an auto load function in the current smart trip loading, or will there be one on the mobile app as well? So it'll work like you do on Easy Pass, where when you hit a certain minimum, it'll automatically load you up. That was actually the question I was going to ask. Will function like the Starbucks app, where you just increase your number and it's there for you to go into the shop and buy your. That's good.
Answer anything. Good morning. Okay. The purpose of this presentation is to inform the Capital Strategic Planning Committee about our rail fleet plan. This presentation will review the purpose and elements that make up the fleet plan, discuss the current status of our fleet, as well as inform the board of some upcoming retirements regarding our fleet, and finally discuss the engineering design and procurement process needed in the 8000 series rail car. Why is it important to have a rail fleet plan? Well, it's an FTA requirement as well as a best practice. Having a plan allows you to manage your fleet to deliver quality service. The plan should estimate fleet and facility needs over a 20-year period, as well as identify replacement or expansion of your fleet, all based on current and future service levels. Some elements that make up a fleet plan are ridership change over time, service level requirements to support current and future ridership levels, expansion of your system, current rail fleet age and their performance, programs that support and extend the life expectancy of your fleet, and finally, storage and maintenance capabilities along with power and system requirements. The 7000 series railcar delivery started in 2015 for a total purchase of 748 cars. To date, Metro has received 528 rail cars, of which 508 are in service right now as of March of 2018. The 1000 series rail cars, the oldest rail cars in the fleet, and the 4000 series rail cars have been retired from service as of 2018. With additional 7000 series rail cars planned for delivery, the 5000 series rail cars will now follow suit and will be decommissioned by the summer of 2019. As of today, Metro has the 2000, the 3000, the 5000, the 6000, and the 7000 series fleet in service and has reduced the average fleet age from 24.5 years in 2015 to 14 years in 2018. The 2000 and 3000 series rail cars, which entered our property in 1983, were designed for a life expectancy of 30 years. A midlife overhaul was performed in 2003, which extended their life to 40 years. Currently, it is our plan for the retirement of the 2000 and the 3000 series fleet, replacing them with the new 8000 series rail cars starting in 2023. The 8000 series railcar program will consist of two separate procurements, the engineering consulting series, which will provide support and augment Metro staff for the engineering task, and the rail car procurement consisting of rail car purchases. Both procurements will be independent of each other, but will be managed by the procurement team to support the 8000 series rail car program. Our first procurement is for engineering consulting services, and our RFP went out on the street in March of 2018, and we are hoping to award that in June of 2018. The second procurement is the actual 8000 series passenger rail car procurement, and currently we are preparing an RFP package. We hope to have that completed by the end of April of 2018 and have an RFP solicitation out on the street in July of 2018. To date, the 8000 series project team has worked with external and internal stakeholders. Lynn Bowersox, the AGM for Customer Service, Communications, and Marketing, has met with the Riders Advisory Council, and they have provided suggestions about what they liked about the 7Ks, what they did not like about the 7Ks, and what they would like to see in the 8000 series. The Accessibility and Advisory Committee has also been engaged to obtain their opinions. The Metro Office of Customer Service and Research, along with assistance from divisions inside the COO organization, has held customer outreach sessions with the help of an outside consultant, Shugel Research, and conducted thorough research that focused on the customer experience based on the 7K program. While the 7K program has proven very popular with the riders, we gathered together a representation sample of our Metro customers and put them on board the 7Ks and actually asked them what they liked and what they disliked and what they wanted to see in the 8000 series rail car procurements. Once we've taken that feedback and now we're beginning to look at renditions of what the interior and exterior of the car might look like, once we complete that, we will bring it back to the same group and ask them, did we meet their expectations or if there's anything else that we need to do. Results from our focus groups indicate that our customers like the 7K rail car from its exterior and interior look, as well as many of its amenities. Here listed are some of the things our passengers like and want to see in our next generation of rail cars. Lessons learned from the 7000 series project have been compiled and reviewed, and additional feedback and comments are being provided to from the 7K project team and its stakeholders. The lessons learned are reviewed and incorporated into the 8000 series program. Internal and external stakeholders continue to provide inputs about the 7000 series rail cars, customers' likes and dislikes, engineering changes implemented as a result of solutions for ongoing or current issues with the 7K program, or changes to contract language or any special provision has also been incorporated as lessons learned and will be put into the 8000 series program. Based on our feedback from our customer focus groups, here are some of the enhancements our customers would like to see. More grab handles in the door entrance areas instead of poles, just grab handles so they can hold on. More media screens, as well as electronic outlets to charge their devices as they ride. And finally, in this slide, you will see the base order line, the minimum rail requirements based on our legacy replacement, and the already programmed service for the Silver Line Phase 2. This does not include any future growth. It merely meets today's capacity requirements. We are analyzing future ridership and service levels and will return to the board and recommend levels for additional rail car options before we exercise any. And that is my presentation on the 8000 series. Well, it's going to be relatively similar based on once the RFP goes out. We need to give the manufacturers about 6 months because there's a give and take when they come back with their proposals, and we need to tune that. Then it takes time for us to actually procure. So we feel about 18 months for the procurement piece of that when it gets finalized. And then it takes about it takes about 16 months to 18 months to get the first pilot cars on board so that they can be tested and we make sure that they meet before they go into real full production of the rail cars. So we are looking at the first rail cars. If we awarded somewhere around 2019, we're probably looking at somewhere around 2023 to get the pilot cars on board and full production to take place.
If the board or management decides that, perhaps from a flexibility standpoint, we need to focus our resources now on, let's say, fixing a tunnel, a red line, or something like that, is there flexibility still built into this procurement process that we could move this one way or the other, either up or coming out up at this point, but back if it was so decided to do so?
Moving it back would cause a would probably start to get into reliabilities of the 2000 and 3000 series. They were originally designed to be 30-year with a 30-year life expectancy. They had a mid-life overhaul that brought them to about 40 years, and the 40th year starts around 2023 when we first get this first set of cars in. So as you start getting the rest of them in, those cars will be in there 41, 42 years old. If we delay the decision now or further down the line, we'll be pushing the envelope when it comes to their life expectancy. So it would probably impact reliability.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee?
No? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you all went out to the industry for comments from the railcar manufacturers, I know there's not a lot of specifications for the 8000 series. Did you guys get into open gangways, wider doors, quad married pairs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Because the 7000 series all have to be hooked up together.
Correct.
Which are all on the other series. Those issues come up?
Yes, they did. When we spoke with our consultant that was on board that was helping us originally with the AK program, part of the issue is the way our shops are designed. Our shops are designed right now to lift deuces and not quads. So if you would go now with a new type of design, you would have to outfit all our shops. So I think that probably decision should have been done when the 7Ks came on. If we were going to go to a different style. Open gangway would become an issue now because you would only have the open gangway inside the deuce and not a quad, which would make more sense if you had it with inside a quad. So I think those decisions are past us now because of the fact that we went with a design for the 7Ks, and I think we need to stick with that in order to for the best business practice right now. That's something we might have to look at once we get rid of the 7000 series. Well, I'm sure.
Any other questions?
Not so much of a – I would want – I mean, I know they're not – you're doing one part. My concern with when we were having delivery issues with the 7000 was that the procurement, the way the procurement was written, I don't believe that there were any penalties for – you know, there was a schedule, but there weren't penalties necessarily in place when they weren't meeting the delivery schedules. You know, we just, particularly when we're in this situation where we must have these things, I mean, I just hope that we will make sure that that is incorporated into this process.
Absolutely.
I was going to say a couple of questions from a finance committee perspective. Joe, your earlier slides show that you now have 358 2000 and 3000 series rail cars, and your final chart here shows you're going to do a procurement for 248. So are you going to retire the other 100 at the same time, or are you going to keep the extra 100 rail cars from 2000, 3000 in the fleet beyond the 40-year lifetime?
That's a great question. No, we won't be
That's why I'm asking you.
We're going to retire those 100. It's just that based on ridership, the current existing fleet plan that we had showed our ridership much further ahead than where we are right now. So as we look at where we are right now, where we believe we're going to be in the next 20 years, we feel the base order we're safe with 250 cars that would keep us current with the current ridership we have now with expansion of ridership. So we don't, of the 348 that we originally had, we don't need them right now. We only need 250. And the options are being built in there in case we see ridership begin to explode. There still be options in the contract to bring on more cars if needed.
Okay. So just to, what you've essentially given us today is a slice of the pie. To understand the broader pie, just two follow-up questions. This is a simple question, but I'm sure there's a complex answer to it. How many rail cars do we need to run this railroad, and how many rail cars do we have today?
Okay, right now I think this will bring us to about 1,200, Jim. So we need, based on the current ridership, where we feel ridership will be within the next 20 years, we feel we need about 1,200 rail cars. Right now, but you have to remember, we're still retiring, we're bringing on new ones. I think we're roughly a little bit over 1,100 rail cars, so we're in good shape when it comes to rail cars and availability. And that 1,200 number, it's a little bit over 1,200, would include what we would need for regular maintenance when we schedule overhauls, as well as a spare factor. So that 1,200 is a good basis for what we need in the future.
So does the 1,200 include the red line ending the Grosvenor turnbacks and phase two silver line, is there a step up for that eventuality in 2 years, 6 months to 2 years down the line?
The 1,200 would include silver line phase two, and we could provide the cars for Grosvenor turnback if it was eliminated. We could do
well,
it.
Well, within the 1,200.
Correct.
Gotcha. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Corcoran. Just a quick question regarding one of the elements that I've heard from the rider community that they'd like to see in future iterations is a reduction. This is for mobility challenged riders, reduction in the gap between the platform and the car, some ability to bridge the gap that exists. Is that going to be a part of the engineering specs that you seek to pursue?
We've discussed that. I think what we're trying to do is do a better job at the alignment of the car versus the platform. So that's what we're looking at. Some of, I know we have some issues with our current boarding areas on some platforms. So what we're looking to do is take care of that in that sense.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, everybody. Mr. Stewart, you've been sitting there overseeing the proceedings of this meeting, and everyone did a great job.
Our next meeting is a Finance Committee meeting. We'll take a 3-minute break for everybody to do whatever they need to do.